campaign to desecrate Islam and hurt Muslims' feelings. The leader of the revolution, Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi, delivered a speech to supporters, praising them for their large attendance. He expressed the birth of the Messenger of God ushered in righteousness, salvation, and light for humanity at a time when the entire world was in a state of darkness. In his words, the Western world and its allies are spearheading corruption and misleading mankind away from God and his prophets. He also advised the West and the Saudi-led coalition to end their war and blockade on Yemen.
If the coalition aggressors are keen on continuing their blockade, aggression and occupation of Yemen, they should know it comes with severe consequences. Our dignified people possess a wide range of powerful means, the first of which is our faith in Allah, our high morals and principles, and our just cause. This gives us the full conviction that with the support of Allah, we will be victorious.
The 2023 birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes amidst peace negotiations between the Saudis and Ansarullah officials, aimed at ending 9 years of war and restoring stability in the region.
The Mawlid is one of the most significant events which takes place every year to show how much Muslims in Yemen cherish and revere Islam's prophet. They are chanting Labbaika Ya Rasulullah, which translates to, we are here to serve you, O Prophet of Islam. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Workers from the now-defunct flag carrier Alitalia met in front of the Ministry of Labour in the Italian capital on Tuesday as part of an action called by the country's base union, CUB. Unionists have been demanding consecutive governments to reinstate thousands of Alitalia workers who have been left in the lurch following years of mismanagement and state-backed rescues. In October 2021, the 74-year-old carrier Alitalia made its final flights, marking the end of an era for Italy. The airline has been replaced by the new national carrier, ITA.
We do not think that under the current crisis the government would be able to redeploy us externally. It is paradoxical that while I'm talking, the government is hiring workers from outside for the three new companies Alitalia has been split into.
The new national carrier, ITA, has only hired around a quarter of the estimated 10,000 Alitalian employees. Alitalia workers have been feeling betrayed by Italy's largest trade unions.
The man you've seen over there is a unionist. When he was hired by Alitalia, he was just a basic pilot. After ITA replaced Alitalia, he became a medium-haul captain, and soon after, a long-haul captain. Practically, the union he works for has sold Alitalia and our contracts off, and coincidentally, he obtained personal gain for that.
The deal, which led to the formation of the new airline company ITA, also called for slashing the number of airline slots at Rome and Milan airports. Italy's government has recently sold a minority stake of the successor of the country's flagship carrier Alitalia to Germany's Lufthansa. However, the European Commission has not approved the deal yet, a decision that has left the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni puzzled.
I'm afraid the EU only wants to transfer more Italian slots to Germany's Lufthansa. Having said that, the deal is not valid, as there is no discontinuity between the old and new national airline. An Italian judge has ruled the position of Brussels on the deal non-binding, and us workers should be rehired.
Former Alitalia workers believe that Brussels has been planning for years to slim down the European airline market to only three major players, British Airways, Air France and Lufthansa. Max Civili, Rome.
When the name of the Jenin refugee camp is mentioned, the first thing that comes to mind is a stronghold for resistance against the Israeli occupation. It has long been seen as the center of Palestinian resistance. Created in the aftermath of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands in 1948, the Jenin refugee camp was established in the early 1950s in the north of the occupied West Bank. The camp is less than half a square kilometer, according to the United Nations. It's home to almost 12,000 residents.
Jenin refugee camp is a great part in our occupied homeland, Palestine. We're speaking about fighters and resistors. We're speaking about a great popular incubator. We're speaking about brave young men as if they are coming from another planet. They have their own necessities of steadfastness. They have a great ability to fight this Israeli occupation. Different components in their life have led to this determination. First, their ancestors were forced out of their towns in 1948. And second, they're still holding to their right of return.
In 2002, during the Second Intifada, Jenin refugee camp was the scene of one of the deadliest large-scale raids by the Israeli military. 60 Palestinians were killed and 250 others were wounded, while hundreds of homes were completely destroyed and more than a quarter of the camp's population were displaced. More than 20 years later, it seems the battle is not over. Last July, Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, but this time, the heavy clashes and exchange of fire forced the Israeli military to retreat in 2 days, leaving 12 Palestinians killed. The military said then the main aim of the operation was targeting Palestinian fighters and capturing their ammunition. Palestinians say Israel had committed war crimes in the refugee camp in an effort to prevent future resistance and bringing down the Jenin Brigade, the newly formed resistance group that's comprised of fighters from different Palestinian armed groups.
What really unites us here in the Jenin refugee camp is not the Palestinian groups, but what unites us is this refugee camp and family closeness. We all live here as one big family. We stand together against the Israeli occupation and against anyone hostile to us.
This is how those resistance fighters think. They are young men living in the camp. I can describe each one of them as a phoenix. They're brave young men insisting on the challenge with simple equipment, personal pistols, explosive devices, and they caused the Israeli occupation great losses.
Israeli military used drones, bulldozers, and hundreds of troops in its army operation as regime troopers hunted down fighters who had grown increasingly bold. Israeli officials thought the regime's military would succeed in breaking the safe haven of the camp. However, they were wrong.
During the Al-Aqsa Intifada, resistance was strong in the refugee camp. The camp has so long been a center for the resistance fighters. With the accumulations, all the raids and destruction and killings establish a struggle in the camp, a non-stop struggle. This means a generation lives and a new generation comes. They are people who reject humiliation and reject all forms of oppression. The residents know the path has always been thorny and difficult, but that's why the people of Jenin will always remain their spearhead in the face of the occupation.
Not only for its residents, but for all the Palestinians, the refugee camp with its warren of alleyways and dilapidated buildings adorned with banners bearing the portraits of martyrs will keep Palestinians recalling their pain and their long history of resistance and fighting. Despite the non-stop Israeli operations in the Jenin refugee camp, the camp continues to be considered a symbol of Palestinian armed resistance. Residents of the camp argue that the latest killings and destruction have not only failed to weaken the Palestinians' resolve, but also helped to increase their resistance and steadfastness. Mona Qandil, Occupy Jenin refugee camp.
The Muslim world has dealt with its fair share of natural disasters over the years, but few would have expected to see the sheer scope of devastation caused by a week of horror across North Africa. Earthquakes, floods, and natural wildfires consuming everything in their path and laying waste to the environment around them.
The first disaster was the horrific earthquake that hit Morocco, a 6.8 magnitude quake which struck at around 11 p.m. local time on the 8th of September. Aftershocks followed on Wednesday the 13th, temporarily hampering rescue efforts there. At least 2,800 people were killed and over 300,000 people remain affected. 1 week on and the humanitarian needs remain incredibly great there. Then there was Storm Daniel, which crashed down on Libya, leading to the collapse of two dams in the city of Derna. The United Nations said in a report released on Sunday that the death toll from the devastating floods that hit that Libyan city, well, that sits at around 11,300 people, although those figures are disputed, with at least another 10,000 people who have still remained missing there. Aid workers fear disease and other crises loom on the horizon, and that will likely add to the toll.
Moroccans continue to live in fear of the inevitable aftershocks, while trying to dig through and recover the bodies of the many thousands still missing.
It's God's will. I was in the kitchen with my daughter-in-law while both my husband and my son were sleeping. When the roof fell on them, they were killed, trapped under the rubble, and nobody could save them. It was God's will.
The violent storms which battered Libya could have been more costly in human life than the tragedy in Morocco. As an entire city, Derna, was overrun, thousands again died in the raging waters, with some claiming the death toll could reach as high as 20,000.
We took the families from the first floor to the fourth floor, and then from here we saw the buildings drift. And we saw Derna completely immersed. In just 10 minutes, the city became submerged. At 5:30, as light came, Hamza and Malik went down to inspect the street, and they told us to come down from the second floor to the C Street and not to go out to the side of the valley. We went down and saw a terrifying sight. People are dead in the streets, cars are destroyed, and homes have collapsed.
The wildfires of Algeria have thankfully been less costly, with no reports of fatalities surfacing. This was the exact same region hit with fires in July, causing the deaths of at least 30 people. Despite these hardships and the immense trauma caused to the victims, these Muslim-majority countries consider these calamities a test of faith and endurance, a natural part of this life.
All the Egyptian people offer their condolences and express their grief to the people of Libya and Morocco. We are offering any assistance that we can provide. Egypt already sent support because the Egyptian people and military are willing to show solidarity with people all around the world, not just Arabs.
As the rescue efforts continue, Muslims across the globe have been sending not just charity, but their prayers too, in the hope of sending strength to the people most afflicted with these biblical-style disasters.
The first days of fall in Iran coincides with the reopening of schools after a three-month-long summer vacation. It marks the start of learning, finding new friends, and getting to read new books. Other than that, students say coming to school paves the way to reach their goals and dreams.
We all have goals that we must strive for. Coming to school is one of the steps that we must take to reach those goals. School provides us with an environment where we can use the lessons studied there to improve and succeed in university. I want to study architecture in university.
They say that even though giving up on their long summer vacation is hard, going to school for them means pursuing their desired future.
It's hard to give up on summer vacation, but I'm doing it to get what I want. I would like to study computer and programming in one of the best universities. I really like this field, and I think as a woman, I can achieve my goals. Why not? We have many women who have studied in the best fields and universities.
Melika is a student who has reached high academic achievements despite her young age. She is a young inventor.
I have an invention that can solve the sensory motor problem of patients with spinal cord injury. In addition, I have worked with various universities and medical students on the treatment of stomach cancer, which has been fruitful.
Iran, a country with high position in scientific rankings, owes many of its achievements to the boys and girls whose eagerness to learn has these days brought them to school. Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not.
O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee, the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Despite questioning economic sanctions from the West, the Islamic Republic has succeeded in developing its aerospace capabilities. Iran has put a third homegrown satellite into orbit, and that's a big deal because sanctions have failed to stop Iran's advancement technologically, especially in the aerospace sector, not to mention many other sectors like the military. Why has Iran been so successful in these advancements? Why has the U.S. maximum pressure campaign failed to stop Iran despite decades of sanctions? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. Our guests for this program are Julie Ghassem joins us. She's a journalist and political analyst. Also joining us is Shabir Rizvi, political commentator.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Julie, I'll first start with you. So we're looking at what's called the NUR 3, and I'm looking at the description. An imaging satellite gone into orbit successfully, placed into a 450-kilometer orbit of the Earth with the Iranian Kaset satellite carrier, which means messenger. And this comes a year and a half after the NUR 2 went into orbit. That altitude was 500 kilometers. And then you also had the NUR 1 back in April 20. Which was the first military reconnaissance satellite launched by Iran. Tell us why this is significant.
Well, the speed of the progress from NUR 1 to NUR 3, which is the most final and most successful edition of the spy satellite, is definitely a feat in itself. The U.S. Played down the NUR 1 a lot, and that was just only 3 years ago. And right now it's a fully capable imaging satellite that's able to really have a full range of capturing all of the U.S.'s spy activities and bases in the illegally put bases in the region, which is what has which is really putting the U.S. on its toes. It's effectively knocked down the Mossad and the U.S.'s monopoly on intelligence and on espionage and imaging, basically, in the region. Now Iran is emerging as a Western agent, a power that's having a homegrown capability over intelligence and over satellite imagery. And, you know, Iran was already really beating off the U.S.'s bases in Iraq and around the region before the satellite. What can this be capable? What can the threats to the U.S. occupation in the region, Mossad presence in the region, reach now that the Nur 3 is successful? This is really worrying the U.S. occupation in Israel. For sure. So much that the U.S., once again, it's launching its military nuclear capability pretext, you know, giving as its opposition to the Nur 3. But, of course, that's just a pretext to basically hide the level of anxiety that the U.S. occupation and its allies have in losing its monopoly on intelligence gathering and technology in the region.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, if we want to take a look at this, Shabir, in terms of what the accomplishment really entails, this technology of satellite carriers is only available to 12 countries. In fact, there are, even though there are countries that produce satellites, but because of this technology of the launcher itself, they don't have the full cycle of space technology. Tell us, of course, what your thoughts are on that. But when our guest there from Beirut says the U.S. monopoly, I think the U.S. wants to monopolize industries like the aerospace, but probably their real interest is the military industry, so that these countries in West Asia, as referred to by us, become reliant on the U.S. when it comes to things like military equipment. Is that a correct perspective on it or way of looking at it?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me. And yes, I believe that's a correct kind of perspective of having it. I mean, if you look at how the United States has handled pretty much any single technology, it can. It looks to monopolize the technology or the field. It looks to dominate it, and it looks to push other people out of the way and have complete control over it. Now, what Iran has done, as you mentioned, with, you know, 11 other countries, Iran being now, you know, the 12th, is it can stand on its own two feet and say, yes, we can do this. That presents a very unique threat to the United States. As you know, the United States has always been trying to put its claws into the region. And now that it has, you know, a significant resistance, not only in the form of, you know, resistance on the ground, but now quite literally resistance in the sky, Iran has effectively leveled the playing field here. And this is a concrete step that Iran is taking into kind of ensuring that the region itself is not reliant on the United States or the West in its entirety, because, you know, Iran is always willing to, you know, look out for its neighbors, be a real key regional player. And unlike the United States, which looks to kind of monopolize and exert control over it, as we see here with Iran joining, for example, BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Council, Iran is really looking for, you know, trade and trust based on mutual growth, mutual trust, mutual respect between two nations. And so what this presents as a challenge to the United States is that Iran can now partner up with these different nations, these different states that are looking to, you know, increase their capacity for production, not rely so much on the United States, and also establish a key economic relationship that isn't predatory, that isn't linked to the IMF, that isn't linked to the World Bank, but rather based off mutual trust and cooperation with Iran and its allied states.
Yeah, and since you're in Beirut there, Julie, in terms of the way that the U.S. has prevented or tried to prevent for example, transfer of Iranian oil to Lebanon, what's wrong with Iran transferring its aerospace technology to Lebanon or its missile technology? I think maybe the U.S. then is very concerned about that because obviously, one of the things that stands out in this region is the Israeli regime. And I think that's probably one of the driving factors that the U.S. has when it comes to preventing Iran from advancing. Is that right?
Yeah, by preventing Iran from advancing, you're preventing the whole region from advancing. you know, aside from the fact that we have limited capabilities in Lebanon, limited military capacity on itself as a small country, our country, Lebanon, has been structurally dependent on the West economically and on the U.S. militarily. And this is done specifically to ensure that there is no independence that's really reached on a military level, but also so that we're always receiving the end of old stockpiles, terrible grade equipment, to keep the country militarily subservient, but also within the bounds and control of the West, so that whatever we have is also ensures that there is that constant dependency. Now, what Iran does in bringing over military technology and oil goods is it breaks that dependency, and it ensures that there is actually some self-sufficiency and some level of sovereignty with Iranian allies in the region that can effectively challenge the comprador dependent status that countries like Lebanon have been in for decades.
President Ebrahim Raisi, Shabir has thanked the aerospace for doing what it did, this major achievement. I'd like to get your thoughts, however, on how he has said once again this has shown that threats and sanctions have no effect on the determination of our dear young scientists for the progress and excellence of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's leader has time and again said that the West's main worry, in particular the U.S., and what they're targeting is these minds, the minds of the youth in particular, and scientists, for example, and how they are the ones that are progressing and advancing Iran with it, and that's what they're targeting. We can talk about the scientists in another question, but just how what you think and whether you agree with what Iran's leader has said in terms of these young minds being targeted, and of course, in this case, in point, in the aerospace industry.
Yeah, of course. No, I agree completely. I mean, I think it's very important to kind of assess exactly what he means by targeting, right? Because the West has several different tactics it deploys in order to ensure that progress is stifled. One, of course, is the very obvious, threat of actually murdering, right? As we've seen time and time again in the past, whether it's the CIA or Mossad flat out assassinating nuclear scientists, the West isn't afraid to not only conduct such horrific acts of cowardice, I would say, but also it flaunts it. It says very openly that, yes, we were responsible, or yes, that we killed XYZ scientists in order to stop progress, in order to, for example, fear-monger the U.S. public into saying these scientists were developing weapons of mass destruction, they were developing nuclear weapons. And then I think there's also the process of using sanctions to target them as well, right? If you lock them out of having a good financial life, if you draw them into the West itself by promising them, oh, you'll get, XYZ, degree, will be able to give you a nice paying job. That's a process that we refer to as brain drain, where you are taking the best that a country has to offer, pulling them out of the country, stifling the country's progress, and then integrating them into the West. And in the West, as we were talking about just a few moments ago, the West is laser focused on creating weapons of murder. They pour billions and billions and billions of dollars, as we see, into their war machines. And into wars such as the Ukraine war, for example, where we have a looming government shutdown happening right now, but the government has essentially said that we'll keep pouring money into weapons of war for Ukraine. And so, again, all this to say that those threats are very real. The United States is constantly looking to sink its teeth into these scientists, into these young minds, and try to either pull them out of the country if they can and have them work for the United States, for example, or just flat out kill them if they can't.
Yeah, the fact that Iranian nuclear scientists have been targeted, Julie, I'm sure is not new news for you. We know how Mossad has operated in that regards, and we know how they have assassinated a number of Iranian scientists in the nuclear field in particular. Now, we know that Iran is not after nuclear weapons. Iran, even not only Israel's intel agencies, but also the U.S., have confirmed that Iran is not after weaponization of its nuclear program. But yet, Israel has targeted Iranian scientists. What are they afraid of? Why do they want to get rid of Iranian scientists?
Well, this was even back in Khomeini's time, he wrote about this. He wrote about how Israel is afraid, the Zionists are afraid, the West is afraid of an intellectual society, an intellectual society that works for sovereignty, and an intellectual society that can build the capability for economic sovereignty, too. As it's, you know, known, as it's been proven from years and years worth of international investigations into Iran's nuclear program, that it's a program of building alternative energy. It's a peaceful nuclear program where Iran can develop like a variety, a diverse array of energy capabilities. That could be the foundation for, its future sovereign scientific development and programs. But again, the development that leads to political as well as economic sovereignty is angers the U.S. and the West more than a military challenge. That is why scientists are the target. That's why youth are the target through soft power. That's why in the latest PSYOP, it focused a lot, like all of the PSYOPs from the West do, they focus on undermining Iran's cultural and social values, especially targeting youth, targeting women, because Iran's social values as a country are the foundation for its development and for encouraging development as a major scientific player today.
Also, Iran's missile program has been obviously a subject that is not sitting well with the U.S. and Israel in turn, Shabir. We know that that has been a thorn on the side of the U.S. for quite some time and still is. I'm trying to understand how it is that the U.S., which was involved in the Iran-Iraq war in terms of providing weapons along with other Western countries where missiles and bombs were raining down on Iran, can expect this country not to have its own missile program. They blame Iran for weaponizing its missile program to carry nuclear warheads. We just had the other day the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu placed a nuclear threat on an international stage by the name of the UNGA at the podium to the entire world, saying there should be a nuclear threat against Iran. Shouldn't Iran be equipped then with missiles, non-nuclear missiles?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, everything the West says about, you know, a country shouldn't arm itself, a country shouldn't have these defensive capabilities is pure hypocrisy, because the moment that, you know, a country would let its guard down, the West is going to take whatever or create whatever boogeyman it can in order to invade it, right? For example, the example I think of almost immediately is Gaddafi's Libya, where Gaddafi kind of put down his arms, and then immediately we saw a NATO-backed invasion that overthrew Gaddafi, and now Libya is a slave state that's suffering from infrastructure collapse. And so I think the threat of nuclear war against Iran from Netanyahu is, one, cowardice. It's, two, it's fear-mongering, right? We all know that Israel is in a very desperate situation right now. It's entering almost its 40th straight week of internal protests. The Netanyahu government is not very popular at all. In fact, on the global stage, no matter which government that's running the occupation. The occupation itself is losing any credibility it had, and it already had very little credibility to start off with. And so all this to say, I think Iran should 100% have the defensive capabilities it thinks it needs in order to protect itself, because the moment I believe that, you know, a country lets its guard down, especially against the West will always, always, always look into penetrating other countries, into sowing chaos, into ensuring that the Western influence is the dominant influence in the region. And we see this now more than ever as the West is willing to actually engage in not only war against Russia, but slowly creeping towards war against China. It's completely willing to fight a multi-front war. And if countries think for one second that the West would hesitate to take advantage of a situation where its guard is down, they would be in for a rude awakening, because the West would 100% exploit any situation it can in order to take over and control any other region it possibly can.
Well, Iran has not actually swayed from its missile program or limited in any shape or form. It actually has advanced it to the point where it is now, from what I'm reading over here, to have the largest missile stockpile in West Asia. And it's the only country to have one that has a range of 2,000 kilometers, which obviously reaches Israel. Julie, my question to you is, there was a case where you had the martyr general, Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani, that was assassinated by the U.S., and Iran retaliated. And it retaliated by using the Fateh 110 family of solid fuel missiles to the U.S. base, the Ain al-Assad base. To show not only its strength, but to give U.S. a little rattling of the cage. There could be other instances where Iran needs to be equipped, and therefore it needs these types of weapons for its defensive posture. Aside from Israel threatening Iran time and again, you also have the U.S. that has that famous saying, "Options, all options are on the table." So Iran has obviously a reason to have these missiles, correct?
Absolutely. Justification and reason, but oh, did you want to say something?
No, I thought you had ended your sentence. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm just going to continue on the answer. So it has justification, it has reason, it has the historical precedent. Any country in Iran's position or in any country in West Asia's position not only has the right to develop itself, but any other option is suicide for it, especially put up against how Iran is probably one of the most targeted countries by the U.S. In the world. After the assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani, this was to send, you know, Iran was sending a message that not only should you really think about continuing to attack Iran in such cowardly ways, but also all options are on the table regionally, just across the region. Just last week, just a couple days ago, not even last week, Yemen was celebrating its anniversary of its revolution, where it's transformed into a sovereign resistance government and administration from its comprador government in 2014. They held a military parade, also showcasing very advanced weaponry that nobody would have thought just a dozen years ago, that Yemen would be in possession of such advanced missiles and weapons. And, you know, the same across the board with Iran's allies in the region. Iran's strength and justification for defending itself, it goes to all of its allies and all of its countries in the position of being in the crosshairs of occupation and imperialist assault. And we can expect that capability to grow across the board. Israel already knows it can't challenge Lebanon militarily. And a lot of U.S. allies in the region that have gone for years head-to-head with resistance access countries are finding that out, that their capability and their morale is being diminished day after day. Iran is clearly sizing up in this equation, and it's all, you know, due to the will of breaking the sanctions that have been put on it since its revolution in 1979. And I think those sanctions have, as Khamenei has said many times, facilitated the opportunity to develop a truly sovereign defense program that our region should look to as a model.
Final question, based on follow-up on what just Julie said there, Shabir. Why does the U.S. continue down a failed road of maximum pressure campaign? It can't suppress Iran's technological advancements and advancements in many other fields. Why doesn't it try to engage? Nobody says they're going to call each other and wish each other Merry Christmas or Happy Nowruz. Nobody wants that. But at the same time, engagement, if they were to have done that, maybe the world wouldn't be where it's at now, where Iran, Saudi Arabia, the region itself is united. There's BRICS, there's SCO that Iran is part of. And their lack of engagement has actually, and maximum pressure campaign, shot themselves in the foot. Why does the U.S. continue down this path? In under a minute, please.
Yeah, in under a minute. Okay, so under a minute. Okay, that's a lot that I'm going to try to crush in here. But essentially, the ideological position of the United States is full hegemony over the world. It likes its unipolar world, and it's willing to fight for it. It's willing to fight dirty for it, as we've seen with assassinations, with maximum pressure campaigns, with pulling out of the JCPOA. And now as we're emerging into this new multipolar world that's, you know, multilateral and power spheres, the United States is not going to want to engage. It knows that if it goes down this route, it will lose all influence in the regions it currently has control over. And so any pivot to that sort of thinking is going to endanger the defense ministry that reeks in billions of dollars. Any pivot to peace from the United States is going to shut down every single military base, all 700 plus of them. And okay. So the bricks will come falling down. Last thing to say, you can't have peace with the United States in its current form because it is a government of warmongers.
Shabir Rizvi there, political commentator from Chicago. Thank you. Julie Kassam, journalist and political analyst from Beirut. A pleasure. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. I'm sorry, of the Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. It's bye-bye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A new study has shown that the top 1% of Americans are responsible for 15% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. According to the study, 15 days for a household in 1/10% emits more than the lifetime of a household in the bottom 10%. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, the richest households are responsible for a vast disproportionate share of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. According to the study published recently in PLOS Climate, the richest 10% of U.S. households are responsible for over 40% of the nation's total greenhouse gas emissions. Further, the top 1% alone account for between 15 and 17% of emissions. In order to arrive at this conclusion, study authors looked at not only household wages, but also investments to determine household wealth and their climate emissions. Doing this, lead author Jared Starr said, allowed researchers to examine how income-generating methods contribute to the climate crisis rather than focusing on consumption. A Star said in a statement, consumption-based approaches to limiting greenhouse gas emissions are regressive. They disproportionately punish the poor while having little impact on the extremely wealthy who tend to save and invest a large share of their income. Consumption-based approaches miss something important. Carbon pollution generates income, but when that income is reinvested into stocks rather than spent on necessities, it isn't subject to a consumption-based carbon tax. Starr, a sustainability researcher at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, went on to turn the traditional question of how carbon emissions are generated and their link to income on its head. Starr asked, "What happens when we focus on how emissions create income rather than how they enable consumption?" The study looked at 30 years of data to determine how investments can support direct and indirect emissions. The study authors examined investment income from a power plant, for instance, which produces emissions both at the power plant and downstream on the supply chain. The higher the income bracket, the higher the proportion of emissions that comes from investment income. The study found further, white Americans had the largest carbon impact, while black households had the lowest share of emissions. Researchers also looked at a group they categorized as super emitters, who create an extremely high amount of emissions per household. They found that almost all super emitters were from the top 0.1% of household income. Starr said, "This research gives us insight into the way that income and investments obscure emissions responsibility. For example, 15 days of income for a top 0.1% household generates as much carbon pollution as a lifetime of income for a household in the bottom 10%. An income-based lens helps us focus in on exactly who is profiting the most from climate-changing carbon pollution and design policies to shift their behavior. According to The Hill, the wealthiest tenth of U.S. households are the source of 40% of national greenhouse gas emissions, according to research published in the journal PLOS Climate. Researchers, led by Jared Starr of the University of Massachusetts, analyzed 3 decades of household income data from 1990 to 2019. They found that during this period, the bottom 90% of households' share of emissions has fallen, while the top 10% share has increased. The wealthiest 1% of households were responsible for between 15% and 17% emissions. Starr and colleagues analyzed emissions associated with businesses owned by households they analyzed, but also factored in revenues relating to their investments. For the top 10%, investment income makes up a large share of those household emissions, between 38% and 42% in the case of the wealthiest 10%. Starr told The Hill in an exclusive interview, "The investment piece makes up an increasing share of the emissions responsibility as we look further up the income ladder." Just over 43% of the wealthiest 0.1% of households, 34%, were what the researchers dubbed super emitters, or those responsible for more than 3,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions per year. They also found wide racial disparities in responsibility for emissions, with non-Hispanic white households comprising the highest income-linked emissions and black households comprising the lowest. According to Hill, emissions also varied by age cohort, peaking between the ages of 45 and 64 and then declining. The results indicate that policymakers may have been looking at potential carbon taxes and their structure from the wrong angle. While consumer-facing carbon taxes have struggled to move from proposal to law in the U.S., an investment-based carbon tax may be more equitable, politically palatable, and equally justifiable, they wrote, while acknowledging that this would likely face pushback from the disproportionate amount of the wealthiest Americans in politics. They wrote, by thinking of carbon as an outcome of income generation rather than just an outcome of consumption, such alternative policy solutions become possible.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines for this hour: Iran once again warns that any geopolitical change in the Caucasus will destabilize the region and escalate the crisis.